On air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Today we'll have Tasmania's Rural Woman of the Year announced just a short time ago at an event in Launceston. Also coming up on the show, you'll hear from the American scientists who helped identify bird flu in Texan dairy cows and lab-grown meat. Targeting the vegan or vegetarian markets, but they're also targeting the meat eaters and offering an alternative.
There's been a lot of arguments all around the world of whether cultured meat products are or aren't meat. But to me, that misses the point. Why we've started now, why we've built this company to this point, is to offer new and distinctive experiences and new and distinctive foods that are different from what animals can produce.
Good afternoon, I'm Fiona Breen. Welcome to the Country Hour. And if you'd like to join the conversation today, 0438 922 936. Would you eat a type of meat, or maybe you wouldn't call it that, made from cultured cells in the lab? We're going to have that story shortly, but first, farms are far from what Bell Binder would consider her natural habitat. Despite this, she's been recognised for her work changing the culture between farmers and seasonal labour forces with the 2024 AgriFutures Rural Women's Award. Bell Binder joins me now. Good afternoon, Bell.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What a fabulous award, a fabulous achievement.
Absolutely, and one I wouldn't thought I'd be standing in 4 years ago when I hadn't really even stepped on the farm, only as a photographer for AusVeg, so there you go.
Well, and you're based up in the northwest of the state and you connect seasonal workers with farmers, don't you?
Yes, that's right. And we developed the Farm Work Loop as a network of farms around Tasmania so that our workers could move either around the state or within their area. And that could be our own Tasmanians, our own locals, travelling Australians, and of course our backpackers around the country as well that are looking for work.
So you've been given a $15,000 grant with this award from AgriFuture.
Yes.
It's the award, the AgriFutures Rural Woman of the Year Award. Now, what do you plan to do with that?
Oh, I'd really love to centre the awareness around the loop. The bigger the loop gets, the more momentum we'll get. So have that grow, will just grow the opportunities and the network of farms around the state and also the opportunities for the workers. And we're only going to bring on friendly farms, so great places to work. You're not going to be yelled and screamed at as well. So it's also a safe connection around that state and those networks there.
Well, it's interesting you say that, you talk about that friendly farms. What are some of the common conflicts between farmers and workers that mean relationships don't always work?
I think some empathy, just understanding both points of view, mutual respect, but the big one, just communication. And so I found with us being sort of that central management system is we can see both sides of a situation because it's a very high-pressured environment. There's low margins and there's a lot of pressure on the farms. And I think communicating both sides to the other party has been paramount in improving the farm environment and just understanding one another. So really communication is central to all of that.
Well, do you think farmers, you know, get what seasonal workers are doing, why they're seeking work, etc.?
I think there's definitely an opportunity to build on that understanding from both sides, to understand what it's like to be a farmer. It's not an easy job, is it? I mean, the hours that are put in, the dedication and the risk that
and
you
the
need
weather,
to take.
Yes, and the risk.
Exactly. So many factors out of our control. So I think it's really important that workers understand where they're coming from and then also the pressures that the workers feel, particularly those on a visa. They're wanting to stay in our beautiful country and to do that, they need to match those visa requirements, which means in some cases doing farm work. And so they've got their own pressures to be understood as well. So I think communication being the key on both sides and just pulling together the best of the best, I suppose, the best farms in the state, the best workers to work on those farms just creates a beautiful environment that works for everybody. You've got high productivity, which is great for the farms, but it's a great feeling as a worker to be productive and to contribute and to understand the farm and why the farm even operates in the first place, what's important to the farm, which in turn creates this wonderful culture of partnership.
So do you mainly deal with backpackers, or are you also talking about other sort of visa holders?
No, so we're about 50% local and 50% backpackers. So, yeah, we're seeing all sides of things from both points of view, from the backpacker, from local to the farmer. So there's very vast range of viewpoints that we share that have brought us to the farm work loop, essentially. We can see the struggles and it puts us in a really good position to go, you know what, I think if we do this, this and this, it'll just completely change the landscape of farming in Tasmania.
What would be some of the tips and tricks to try and get some of the backpackers or farm workers to stay on? Because, I mean, ultimately some of these people are over here on holidays as well.
Oh, well, I think that's where we've created an environment of having that adventure while you're in that circumstance, ticking off your 88 days, say, for that second year visa, where, yeah, they're absolutely here for a holiday. So let's make it work. So then they're staying in the state for longer, which is really great for retention, also for skill sharing as well. So they might be working on a farm on the northwest coast and they want to go and explore the Hobart area. They can then pivot down to a farm that's on the loop down the Hobart area. They bring that set of skills down to that farm, which is so valuable for our farmers. But we've got the retention, and which then goes into tourism as well, keeping them in the state. It's just the more farms we've got on the loop, the more retention we find within the farms themselves and obviously our state as well.
Yeah, okay. Bel Binder, the 2024 Rural Woman of the Year. Congratulations. I suppose you won't really know what's going to happen after this, but you will be off to a national final later in the year.
Yes, I'm very excited about that exposure with the farm work loop. It's what it needs to grow, and, yeah, I'm really looking forward to what is ahead.
Bel Binder, thanks for joining the Country Hour.
Thank you, Fiona.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, we heard yesterday that King Island farmers were starting to get creative with feed for their livestock during this dry. The island didn't get a reprieve from the dry like many other places in Tasmania earlier this week, which got some rain. Problems with shipping feed from mainland Tasmania has also caused some issues. Audrey Hamer runs King Island Stock Feeds and Rural Supply. She said they've just had to return 7 pallets of feed due to changes from biosecurity.
So now we cannot buy like just one or two bags of anything with grain or seed. We have to buy a pallet lot because then the manufacturer will do the paperwork on the analysis of the seed and the grain. So now we can't get any of that. Like, we've got customers wanting lupins, but we cannot afford to buy a full pallet of lupins. We have nowhere to store it because, you know, like, they only want 2 or 3 bags maybe a month. So we can't get that. We can't get that out of Tasmania. But we are getting a lot of other things out of Tasmania now, grain-free, the cattle pellets for all these farmers in the drought. So they're grain-free from Tas Stock Feeds. And then we're getting from the seed house, we're getting our grains and seeds from them, which is at more of a cost.
Yeah, sounds like people have to get creative. And last month there was an issue with biosecurity. What happened there?
Yeah, well, they're putting their foot down with what we're bringing in because we don't have the exact paperwork for one or two bags. You only get the paperwork if you buy a pallet full, like I said, just, you know, like previous, that we have to buy a pallet lot. And we cannot afford that. Like, this business is just my husband, Wayne, and myself. It's our money. Like, we're not a big corporate business. So we can't afford to go and buy a whole pallet full of something because it takes us, you know, normally maybe a couple of months to sell. But at the moment, we've done that because of the drought. People are buying more of it, but the things that we only need one or two bags of, you know, per month, we just can't do it.
So it's had quite a big impact on your business?
Oh, absolutely. Like when I spoke to biosecurity one-on-one and explained the situation, he said, oh, I didn't really realise this, but he said he's doing his job. But like I said, they're not planting this grain in the ground. The horses and cattle and birds are eating it. It's been going on for 30 years and we don't have any weed problem that we're aware of. Like, but he said if it did become a problem, then it'd be a massive problem for King Island. But it's the same that we've been doing, like I said, for at least 30 years when we started this business. So I don't know. I mean, I can see their point that they're doing their job, but it's very hard, especially at this time, for everybody because King Island's never been in a drought like this before. And see, the cost, see, everything that we get comes out of Melbourne, out of Victoria. It's just cheap to buy the product for us out of Victoria. So then it goes from there, gets loaded in Laverton North, goes on sea road shipping across to Devonport. Then it's got to go from one side of the river to the other side to Bass Island Line, and then it comes here. So anyone who wants to freight anything, it really needs to be at our depot by Wednesday, and then we don't get it here to the following Wednesday. So, you know, like you need to order it, you've got to get your supplier to get it there. So it's at least 10 days or to 2 weeks, you know, that you've got to order in advance. Like, It is challenging living on King Island, especially at this time. Like, I really feel for the farmers not being able to ship the cattle off.
And from your perspective, do you feel like you've got enough to provide to farmers in terms of the feed?
Yes, we're able to get enough, yes. We've got another container coming on this boat or next week. So we Tasmania, the grain-free food, which we are able to get. But it's not just the feed. A lot of farmers are struggling with water. There's no water in the dams, you know, like, so that's going to be the next issue.
And that was Audrey Hamer there telling our reporter Madeline Rojan about the difficulties of supplying feed to farmers on King Island at the moment. Now, would you eat a product grown in the lab from meat cells? A new company called Vow has become the first Australian business to receive approval from the Singaporean Food Agency to sell a product derived from Japanese quail. And it hopes to receive similar approval from the Australian regulator to sell to Australian consumers. Angus Furley spoke with Vow Chief Executive George Pepu a short time ago.
Today we announced that Vow is officially approved and on sale in Singapore with our very first product, which is a cultured Japanese quail. So made from cultured animal cells, which were originally derived from a Japanese quail, and now available in some of the best venues across Singapore.
Why Singapore?
We've been working with regulators across a bunch of different markets, including Australia and Singapore. And Singapore was the first market which we reached approval. It's also a really good market to launch a luxury product like we're producing in, under our brand, our sort of premium brand Forged. It's a very, very high-end dining scene here. With a really wide variety of different cuisines from all over the world. And frankly, some of the best chefs in the world choose to open restaurants in Singapore. You've got a really adventurous local foodie group, sort of foodie population, alongside a lot of travelers coming from all over the world. So it's a really good place to introduce something really new and distinctive, like what we're producing.
So a high-end product, what sort of price are we talking?
I'd say think of it as a... amongst the highest price point of any kind of animal protein you'd find. I can't share the exact numbers It's a little bit commercially sensitive, but it would be amongst the most expensive proteins you'd find anywhere from any kind of distributor in Singapore.
And is that going to be your approach as you develop other products, or will you be looking to go across different price points?
Definitely go across different price points, but our whole strategy as a business has always been to say, hey, farmers are really good at producing the meat we know today. There's no point trying to replicate beef, chicken, or pork. It's a fool's errand. I love eating meat myself, and there's no way that I'm going to be tricked, let alone we're going to trick anyone else into thinking they're eating a new version of the same thing. Mm-hmm. So instead, let's use this new technology to offer something which is distinctive from what we already consume. And we're starting off by introducing that into these really high-end venues based on the novelty and distinctiveness that we've been able to create because we have access to this new sort of toolkit of cultured meat. But then as we sort of move down market, as our scale increases and our cost structure improves, we're looking at the areas like improved nutrition. So for groups which have particularly high nutritional needs, whether that's particular nutrients you'd otherwise find in meat, or certain protein goals or requirements, or wanting more nutrient density and a smaller serve size, serving some of those niche markets at a lower price point. Hopefully one day, being able to offer some of these really distinctive offerings at a supermarket level, but sold purely as brands in the same way you might buy a breakfast cereal, not sold as animals.
So you're marketing to meat eaters, people who love meat but are looking to try something new or different?
Exactly. There's a massive growing global demand in meat consumption, and making anything, if that's a problem you want to sort of contribute to, making anything that's being sold to vegans or vegetarians is a waste of time. Let them eat tofu. We want to be adding new offerings to the diet of people that already choose to eat meat and enjoy doing so.
Are your products actually meat?
You can have a look at what Food Standards ANZ said on this. It kind of doesn't matter from my point of view. As long as we're serving them on the same plate or in sort of a similar occasion where people would otherwise eat meat. There's been a lot of arguments all around the world of whether cultured meat products are or aren't meat. But to me, that misses the point. Why we've started now, why we've built this company to this point, is to offer new and distinctive experiences and new and distinctive foods that are different from what animals can produce. And so whether we call it meat or not, it's actually kind of immaterial, because we want people to be just adding this to their diets in similar occasions, regardless of what it's called.
You don't need to go into the technicalities, but can you just give a basic overview of how these products are actually produced?
Absolutely. So we start with a small sample from basically any animal. In the case of this first Singapore approval, it's a small sample of quail. We then go through a process to select for the cells that would repair the tissues that you find in meat, so muscle, fat, and connective tissue. We take those cells and we place them in an environment and feed them everything they get otherwise, so sugars, salts, amino acids, vitamins and minerals, and a few other bits and pieces. And then we place all of that, so that nutritional liquid and the cells, into a very, very clean stainless steel tank where we basically let them grow. And then we separate out the cells, add a few bits and pieces, in the case of the parfait, a bit of butter, garlic, thyme, brandy and cognac, and then package it up and send it off.
What's your output, your volume of production at the moment?
Right now, out of our current facility, 100 kilos in a good month. So we're at a relatively small scale. We have a much larger facility we're working on at the moment, but even still, even in our most aggressive, most optimistic timelines, we're going to be the size of a large farm in a couple of years. It's like, in terms of output, there's a long way for us to go.
So you've got approval in Singapore. You're also seeking approval to sell in the Australian market?
That's correct, yes.
And where is that process at?
So in Australia, we've gone through the first public consultation period earlier this year. There's a second public consultation period that the food regulator is opening up in the coming weeks around the sort of final wording that they're intending to use in amending the Food Act. And then the timeline will be updated on their website when they have a new estimate. The last estimate was towards the end of this year for them wrapping up that assessment.
And that was VAL Chief Executive George Papou speaking with Angus Verley. Time now to talk about trees. Sustainable Timber Tasmania has made a change to its giant tree policy. It will now declare trees that have a diameter of 4 metres or 1.3 metres above the ground as giant. It means they get protection and an informal reserve created around them. Adam Holmes from the newsroom joins us to explain what this means for forestry. Now, Adam, I was thinking about, welcome, by the way, to the country, huh?
G'day, Fiona.
Now, I was thinking about how high that is. So, you know, if I'm about 5'4", that's probably about chest height. That's the diameter. So if you see one of those big logs laying on the ground, for someone fairly average like me, in a woman's height, it'd be about chest height. It's still pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah, they describe it as at chest height is where they take the 4 metre diameter measurement from. So when you stand against a standing tree, about 1.3 metres above the ground is where they take the measurement to determine if something's 4 metres
in. Oh, right, they put the measuring tape round the tree.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah. They sort of across, I think, is across the diameter through the, sort of across.
Yeah, okay, now we've got that. If we can imagine that, let's get down to business. So how is this a change on previous policy?
Yeah, so it is quite complicated. It's kind of an addition to their old policy. So they previously defined a giant tree as being taller than 85 metres or greater than 280 cubic metres in volume. And that was it. That was the entire previous definition. That would usually amount to about 5 metres in diameter or across at that chest height level, which when we think about trees, that really is really, really big.
That's
like 5 metres.
That's really big.
Quite
wow.
Long. When you think about it across, and very few trees in Tasmania even really reach that size. So STT has now added a 4 metre diameter metric to the definition. So that's like an or definition. So if it's 85 metres tall or 4 metres in diameter, then it won't come down. So if it meets one of those two things. So it just brings the giant tree policy in a little bit, marginally, perhaps.
So why do you think they've taken this step and what's been the reaction?
So in terms of explaining why they do things, STT is probably one of the least forthcoming of Tasmania's government business enterprises. Their responses to media are always quite vague and generic. So we can't exactly say why they decided to do this, but we can speculate, however, which we all love doing. You might remember last year there were those single rider tree logs that were transported through the centre of Hobart. So those are logs that are so large they can only just fit on the back of... You can only just get one log on the back of a truck.
And there were pictures sort of around on social media, et cetera.
Yeah, and they generated some international attention and I guess a bit more scrutiny of Tasmania's native forest practices. There are also other images of single rider logs being transported, I think, out of the Styx Valley. Environmental groups will say that this changed giant tree policy might be in response to some of that attention to try to manage STT's image a little bit. But it's also worth pointing out that those very large tree logs that we saw on the back of trucks, they probably wouldn't meet the 4 metre in diameter measurement either. They look about maybe three metres, at least looking at the images they do. I didn't get the tape measure out. Those size trees still wouldn't actually be protected in this giant tree policy anyway.
Wow. Okay. And you've got a picture of those size trees on your digital article on the ABC news page, haven't you?
Yeah, of those trees on the back of trucks, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, getting to some of the policies, given the Liberals won the election, well, sort of, actually. We haven't quite got there completely, have we? We're still counting everything.
Yes, a win's a win.
A win's a win, yeah. Will their policy of making an additional 40,000 hectares of native forests available for logging come to pass, do you think?
So that was the relevant minister, Felix Ellis's big policy announcement during the election, which appeared to be something the industry hadn't specifically been asking for.
I remember you making calls, or a couple of people making calls in the newsroom, and there was sort of a bit of... out there in industry, there's what?
Yes, I think that view is similar now to when it was, and they weren't there at the announcement, which is always somewhat telling. I think that policy is still the policy of the Liberal Party, I guess, until further notice.
But they'll have a few people to negotiate with.
Yes. Yeah, so to my understanding of how this works, those changes to the wood bank, or as the Liberals like to call it, they require the approval of both houses of Parliament. So that's one of many policies that are now up in the air after the election, given the Liberals look on track to only get 14 seats in the new parliament. So they'll need 4 crossbenchers to support their legislation just in the lower house. And this might start getting into the realm of hypotheticals and speculation again, but to get that 40,000 hectare policy through, they would need either the support of Labor, who say they don't support it, or the Jackie Lambie network, and one other on top of the Jackie Lambie network. And we don't know, the JLN might be sympathetic to native forestry, but the other independents might not be, like Christy Johnston,
yes.
It wouldn't be, David O'Byrne, probably a similar approach to Labor. Craig Garland, who looks like getting elected, could be a challenge. And then it has to pass the upper house after that as well, where it's going to be independent majority again, most likely. So from my reading, that 40,000 policy looks like it faces a difficult path, unless they can find a way to get it done like through regulation, so where it doesn't have to go through Parliament, but that also seems unlikely.
Sounds like there'll be quite a few hoops to go through, and it might be a little bit hard.
But in general for the native forestry sector, I don't think it has too much to worry about in the new Parliament generally, as both Labor and the Liberals do support native forestry in Tasmania.
Yeah, okay. Adam Holmes, thanks so much for coming in and taking us through all that and the big tree policy. We'll catch you again next time.
I look forward to it.
Now it's time for the news headlines with Alison Costello.
Thanks, Fiona. Making news, former Seven producer Taylor Auerbach is standing by claims he was offered a promotion and a pay rise when he tried to resign. That was, a court has heard, after he charged massages to a corporate credit card while trying to entice Bruce Lehrman into an exclusive interview. Network Seven issued a statement overnight flatly denying it made any such offer to Mr. Auerbach, who's giving evidence in Bruce Lehrman's defamation case against Network 10. The White House has welcomed Israel's announcement it will increase the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Earlier, the US President Joe Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that America will change its policy towards Israel if it doesn't do more to protect civilians and aid workers in Gaza. Israel's been facing international pressure after it admitted that an airstrike, which it describes as a tragic mistake, killed 7 charity workers who were delivering food to starving Palestinians. And 159 current and retired police and emergency service workers are being recognised at ceremonies across Tasmania in the coming days. The first ceremony has been held in Hobart this morning, where the inaugural Investigator of the Year award went to Detective Senior Constable Melanie Nichols from the Sirius Organised Crime Unit. There'll be ceremonies in Burnie and Launceston early next week. Fiona.
Thank you very much, Alison. Time now to head to the Weather Bureau and Ellie Matthews. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
Now tell me, was there much rainfall overnight?
So in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning, we only saw 1 to 2 millimetres falling in the very far southwest, but otherwise there was no rainfall recorded across the state overnight. But since 9 a.m. this morning, we've seen some light falls about the east coast, just a tick under a millimetre about St Patrick's Head near St Mary's today. And in terms of rainfall on the forecast today and into tomorrow, we've got some cloud building across the north. There'll be some possible light showers in the northeast and the northwest, but not amounting to much. And same with tomorrow, we've got light showers developing in the north and east, but it'll be likely less than 2 millimetres for tomorrow. It's on Sunday that the rain is to come. So we've got a low pressure system that'll pass offshore to our east, bringing some showers statewide on Sunday, and it'll be tending to rain about parts of the east coast for a period during the day. So what we're expecting in terms of amounts of rain, we're looking at 0 to 2 millimetres in the west, more 2 to 10 millimetres about central parts, and then on the east coast this could be 10 to 20 millimetres with some coastal and elevated parts seeing possibly slightly more than this.
Okay. Now, any more in the outlook?
In the outlook, we're looking on Monday, some westerlies will push showers into the west, but it won't be until a cold fronts to cross later in the day on Monday that showers will extend statewide for a period in that overnight Monday into Tuesday. This will be not great amounts, as not as much as we'll see on the Sunday. Probably what's more significant with this cold front is the cooler air that it'll bring with it. So we're looking at potential for snowfall coming down to 900 metres in parts of the state on Monday night. So, and then it'll be cool into the outlook there.
All right. Any warnings at all?
For tomorrow, we have a strong wind warning for northeastern coastal waters between the northern tip of Flinders Island and St Helens Point.
Coastal waters and swell.
So today we've currently got variable winds below 10 knots about most waters in the south, west and northwesterly 10 to 20 knots, which is going to ease out very soon in the early afternoon. Winds are tending east to northeasterly 10 to 15 knots about the north and east later today. And into tomorrow, it'll be an east to northeasterly winds 10 to 20 knots, possibly reaching up to 25 to 30 knots during the evening in that far northeast. The winds will be variable below 10 knots in the west. And in terms of swells, in the west and south, we've got a southwesterly 2.5 to 3.5 metres with the significant wave height currently sitting at 2.7 metres at Cape Sorel. And that same swell continues into tomorrow for the west and south. Across the north today, we've got a westerly below 1 metre. And into tomorrow, that'll become confused about that 1 metre height. And in the east today, we've got a southerly 1 to 2 metres tending southwesterly 2.5 to 3 metres offshore in the south. And tomorrow we've got a northeasterly swell that'll build to 1 to 2 metres in the afternoon. There'll also be that southerly swell 1 to 2 metres tending southwesterly 2.5 to 3 metres offshore in the south.
All right. Ellie Matthews, thanks very much.
Cheers, Fiona.
Eating is sumptuous, one of life's great pleasures. Until one day, some ingredients and recipes just don't agree with you. Your body's changing and you don't have the appetite you used to. And suddenly, someone who's spherical at 40 is thin as a bean at 70. So, you may need to modify the way you eat. Dietitian Nairi Hobbins is here to help you pack all you need into smaller servings. I'm Mel Bush. Join me for Nutrition Talkback tomorrow morning at 10 from ABC Radio Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Time to take a little breather now with the Rolling Stones.
My sweet Lady Jane, when I see you again, your servant am I, and will humbly remain. Just heed this plea, my love, on bended knee, my love, I pledge myself to Lady Jane. My dear Lady Anne, I've done what I can. I must take my leave, for promised I am. My love, your time has come, my love, I pledge my troth to Lady Jane.
sweet Marie. I wait at your ease. The sands have run out for your lady and me. Wedlock is nigh, my love. Her station's right, my love. Life is secure with Lady Jane.
Lady Jane by the Rolling Stones. Something a little bit different.
You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, a cat was one of the clues that led scientists in the United States to test dairy herds for bird flu. Within 1 week, four states in the US reported outbreaks among dairy cattle of highly pathogenic avian influenza. Dr. Alicia Fry works in New York State's Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, which is part of Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Fry told reporter Fiona Broom how the team identified bird flu in Texan dairy cows.
A classmate of mine, who is a dairy veterinarian, contacted me in early March, and we were beginning to hear reports of widespread cattle illness in the panhandle of Texas. He contacted me to ask what samples I thought he should collect from the sick cattle in order to do some testing. Of course, we didn't know exactly what we were looking for at the time, so we discussed different samples that he could collect from the sick cows and then ship them to us at the lab.
So once you got the samples, what did you do from there? Was it a process of elimination? Did avian influenza immediately jump to mind?
It didn't at first. We did have a bit of back and forth about how to test. We ended up doing what's called exploratory sequencing with our virology laboratory, and that is kind of casting a wide net for different viruses and looking through the sample types for them. I'm not an expert in that field specifically, but we decided to, it's called sequencing or whole genome sequencing. So we did a sequencing technique to see what we could find basically in the samples. And so we looked in milk and we looked in nasal swabs or swabs from the cow's noses. Meanwhile, while that was underway, the same veterinarian reported more than typical numbers of dead birds on the farm and also dead barn cats. As you know, cats often live on dairy farms. So he also sent us a cat and some birds, which we did test for HPAI. And so those were positive, and that was kind of when I started worrying more about high path AI or considering it, I guess, was when, the reports of the birds and the cat came through, as carnivores have been getting HPAI in the U.S. for a bit now. So that's known information. And so about the same time that the cat and the birds were positive, the milk was also positive here at our lab, and a nasal swab as well.
Has this type of avian influenza or any avian influenza made the jump to cows before?
To my knowledge, and also, my virologist at the lab, Dr. Deal, who did the sequencing, we are not aware of it being transmitted to cows. I believe they have done some studies and previously know. So this is new species for HPAI.
How quickly has that outbreak developed in the U.S.?
The USDA made an announcement on March 25th, I believe, about the Texas and then another state, Kansas, and now I believe we're up to four states or so. So it's less than a week's time, I believe, the announcements have come out.
Is this cow-to-cow transmission, or do we not know that yet?
We are starting to consider cow-to-cow transmission, yes.
What could this potentially mean for the dairy industry or livestock industries across the United States?
Yeah, I think the good news is the cows are getting better. It seems to have almost no mortality, so almost no deaths attributed to it, or very, very few. Some herds are already seeing their cows rebound and feel better.
Producers in Australia are curious about the processes that are in place in the United States. What do you know about containment biosecurity strategies in the US? Are the infected cows being destroyed, or they're being allowed to recover and return back to dairy production?
At this time, there has been no destruction of cattle, and that's not in the works to my knowledge. Farmers are required to dump milk that looks unhealthy and not sell it. So I think this is very new, and regulations, I'm not involved in making regulations, but at this time, there have been no culling or anything of affected animals, just not putting their milk into the production line.
What's the feeling in the scientific community in the United States about these outbreaks? You know, are alarm bells going off within agricultural industries or within the scientific community about this potentially spreading and becoming more widespread?
The fact that it's kind of sprinkled to other states so quickly, you know, is probably, you know, alluding to that as being a possibility. And there is a lot of movement of cattle in the country, the way that, you know, the large farms sometimes have different facilities, or they, you know, some of the baby calves might be raised in one location and the adults on a different location. So that's just one of the ways that cattle are managed. So that could be a component, yes. I just before we talked, I had remembered reading that, you know, it was detected all the way in Antarctica, which is a little bit closer to you guys in Australia. So I think this HPAI, it's been documented in wildlife, in, you know, different continents, in different mammalian species. You know, it is interesting, and it's spread for different hosts, I guess, now including ruminants.
Are there concerns about the potential spread to humans now that it's made this jump to dairy cows?
There was a USDA report of one dairy worker with mild symptoms who tested positive. I think generally the concern is still very low. You know, there's been only one other human case in 2022 from contact with poultry. So it does seem like the risk to humans is very low at this time, which is comforting. And for me, I think the knowledge that the cattle are recovering is also encouraging.
Dr. Elisha Fry from New York's Cornell University speaking with Fiona Broom. Now, the national task force that's looking for a way forward for the struggling interstate wine sector has begun visiting the big inland production regions. The working group, which is made up of government and industry representatives, was formed in response to concerns about historically low wine grape prices this vintage amid a glut of red wine. It met with growers and winemakers in the South Australian Riverland last week, the New South Wales Riviera yesterday, Riverina, I should say, yesterday, and the Mildura region next week. Other states will have virtual hearings, and people are being encouraged to make submissions through their industry groups.
Looking into the oversupply of red wine, what each jurisdiction in response to the issues that we have on our hands currently is doing, and what else can be done, and provide some suggestions back to the agricultural ministers for consideration.
And from what you've been hearing from winemakers and growers so far, do you feel that the industry really is at a crisis point here in terms of oversupply for that red wine, but also more generally?
There is no doubt that very loud and clear we hear from our grape growers that they are in pain, and there are issues associated with the way that they can grow and they can get return on the investment and on the work that they do. There is no doubt that there have been issues over the last few years in selling our wine at the level that we could do that before a number of matters like COVID, flood in this region, and the Chinese market took place. We all heard that China market is open again, and it's just a matter of that looking optimistically into what set of support can be provided to really bring back these guys on a sustainable and viable supply and business into the future.
It's been suggested that exit packages or financial assistance for growers who do want to leave the industry to remove vines to perhaps plant something else would be valuable to address that oversupply issue. Has that been raised with your working group so far?
I have to say that different views around that. Yes, definitely there have been certain individuals and growers or regions that they believe that exit from the industry, reducing the supply is the solution. There are views around more promotion, marketing, getting the product out of the door in a quicker manner could be the solution. Transition maybe to other crops have been raised as well. But as I say, there have been really different views at different, you know, from different groups and from different locations or regions that we visit.
You mentioned that you were charged essentially by the agriculture ministers, both Commonwealth and state, at their recent meeting to have this investigation. How confident are you that there will be an appetite or a will to implement any recommendations that you might come up with?
I mean, there have been a communique from the ministerial meetings. It's very clearly talking about establishment of this working group. There have been media release from my minister, Minister Scriven, and also Minister Watt, the Commonwealth Minister. There is commitment to the work that is underway. It's publicly said. It's just a matter of that whatever we do, obviously, is subject to consideration. We just need to complete our task and provide that input back to our ministers for them to consider and decide.
That was Mehdi Daroudi, who is the chairman of the Wine Industry Working Group. Now, let's take a trip back to the late 1950s, when shearers went on strike demanding a 7% increase in pay. The timing couldn't have been better for Matt Kidd, who was 19 and needed money and easily found work as a beginner shearer. Claire Burberry sat down with Mac at his home on the Tamar River to hear how the industry has changed since then.
I started in 1958, not knowing there was a shearer's strike on when people wanted a shearer, and you could earn as much in 2 days shearing as you could in a week, as the basic wage was in those days. So I learned to shear because of starvation.
Right. Did you start because there was a shearer's strike, or you started and didn't realise there was a shearer's strike?
I didn't realise there was a shearer strike, and I wondered why everyone wanted me to shear their sheep.
And tell us how you learnt how to shear.
Oh, I had a gentleman came out here from Alfred Harrop's and gave me a few clues, and then the rest was self-taught.
And how old were you when this happened?
19. Then I got better, and so I got more money. Then I had a friend, Graham Cowley, and we decided we'd go contracting together. So we went out and got a few sheds and contracted them.
What was the organisation of shearing like when you were in your 20s in terms of working it out with the farmer?
Oh, well, the farmer would just ask us to go and shear his sheep and supply shed hands, wool classes and the presser. And in the bigger sheds, the cook as well.
Because that's all changed now. I noticed that shearers will get a meal allowance. Is that because there's probably not many cooks about?
That was started really when the graziers decided to let their accommodation fall apart. And so then they had to come to another alternative. And that was the meal allowance was really travelling allowance. Well, prior to the 1970s, the shearing in Tasmania only took place from September till December in the springtime, because everyone thought that was the right time to shear the sheep. The wool was better then. It had the grease was coming up in it. But then there was a change that when some of the farmers decided to pre-lamb shear. That made it better on the ewe because she wasn't laden with wool and saturated with moisture, and she looked after her lambs better because she went for shelter. So that really was the start of the breakdown of seasonal shearing in Tasmania. When the seasonal shearing was on, well, then the shearers would all shear the sheep here, and then they would move to the mainland and follow their sheds round there. When the shearing season came here, they'd all return home, plus quite a number of mainland shearers would come down here then and do the run till Christmas. But the pre-lamb shearing then gave the local shearers more work, so they didn't have to go away, and then everyone took to the shearing in the winter. Prior to that, they thought they were all going to die if you shore them in the winter, but as it had been shown that more sheep died in rough weather in October than they did in June.
When the
And that was retired shearer Matt Kidd talking to Claire Burberry. We just cut that off there a little bit. Sorry there, Matt Kidd. But Richard Bailey, you know, different times, hey?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting interview. Mac's very well known around the industry. He was a big, big shearing contractor for many, many years. And I noticed him at Piranha yesterday, so he's still going well.
There you go. Well, speaking of Piranha, how are the markets?
Yesterday was good. Look, Elders held their second sale, 2,500 weaners, and it's what they call their Hereford special. And the first two runs, two lanes of pens in the shed were all Herefords yesterday. Magnificent lineup. And then the rest of them then were mainly Angus and Angus Cross. So the market, as you would expect after a rain, the market improved a little bit, anywhere from $50 to $100, and in cases a little bit more perhaps. Only 35% were bought to go out, which is quite a lot less than the 50 and 60% that we did have. Just as a quick quote, heavy weaner steers 810 to 1320 to average 315 cents. Medium weight 750 to $1,000 to average 300 cents. Light 450 to 840 to average 315. And very small 260 to $580 a head. Over in the heifers, the best heifers made 620 to $1,000. The ranges, the percent ranges here were massive because of some were bought to be breeders, but anywhere from 190 to 250 cents a kilo. Medium weight 670 to 800 cents, 225 cents. That was 670 to $800, not cents. $450 to $680 for light and very light, 260 to $520 a head. Most of those heifers in that range were anywhere from sort of 220 to 240 cents a kilo. There were odd pens up to 300 cents, but the averages were in that bracket. So good day, and obviously the talking point was the rain, and in odd cases the lack of it, but generally speaking, the rain.
Okay, what about sheep and lamb?
Just a reminder on this that we did miss Monday because of the long weekend, so there were cattle sales, and the major cattle sales in Eastern Australia didn't take place, and no Bendigo lamb-wise. We got to Ballarat on Tuesday, just a little bit better. Hamilton a little bit better. Then we got to Wagga yesterday, and they quoted them anywhere from $10 to $20 better. Most of the averages, lamb averages during the week, sat between 650 and 700 cents a kilo. They had to be pretty good lambs to make 700 cents, but there were a lot of averages in that 670 to 680 cents a kilo. Good news again. Mutton market started the week a little bit easy, but got to Hamilton and Wagga yesterday. Very quickly got to 280 to 300 cents a kilo.
All right, Richard Bailey, thanks very much.
Good on you, Fiona.
And we've got Joel Reinberger. Good afternoon, Joel.
Good afternoon there, Fiona. I've been watching this interesting woman on TikTok talking about spiders. Now, she's an American, and she's talking about how if you do the kind thing and, you know, put the spider in, you know, put the jar over the spider and the paper underneath and you take it outside, she said most of the spiders that people catch are actually basically domesticated.
Right.
They are indoor spiders, and they're not really set up anymore for being outside. That you know, because there's a whole argument, actually, you're killing these spiders by putting them outside because they're somewhere unfamiliar where they're not set up to do. So we're going to talk to someone today, a spider expert, about is that true of Australian spiders? Because literally there are spiders that have been indoor spiders since Roman times.
All right.
Since the Roman Empire.
I don't always move a daddy long legs, for example.
Yes, yeah,
but
exactly.
But I don't love tarantulas.
The black house spider is the classic one you find in the corner of the windowsill.
Yes, yeah.
So we're going to find out, you know, do these things actually live outside or do they just really very much prefer to be in your home? Have we imported this or are Australian spiders still tough, rugged, outdoorsy spiders that can handle? I mean, I know huntsmen can. Huntsmen are very happy outside. They just happen to adapt to inside. We're also going to check in with Steph Gebby, who is a Tasmanian who is riding a horse across Canada.
Now, this is amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Her and her friend's going with her, and her friend's only just been learning to ride recently. So we'll find out how she's coping with the saddle soreness.
All right. Thanks very much, Joel Reinberger. I'll join me again on the Country Hour at noon on Monday.
The ABC Listen app gives you ABC Radio Hobart the way you want it. So when the footy's on, you can cheer your team on. But if you want a different option, just choose one of your favourite programs instead. Download the free ABC Listen app today.